You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. You're listening to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Thank you for subscribing on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Himalaya. My name is David Ramil. We have a special guest today. He covers the NBA for Bleacher Report and is the author of Tanking to the Top, The Philadelphia 76ers, and the Most Audacious Process in the History of Professional Sports. It's Yaron Weitzman. Yaron, how are you?
I'm okay. Hanging in as much as any of us, right? So, yeah, I'm okay. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, the reason why you're on the show is because on Thursday, you published a piece for Bleacher's ongoing 30 Teams in 30 Days series, where there's a feature written on every NBA franchise, and yours was about the Miami Heat, and it was titled Heat's Secret Sauce. What was the motivation for you to talk about that particular aspect of the team?
So this is actually a little peek behind the curtain, right? So all season, I think all season I had been reporting a story on what player development looks like in the NBA, like what player development is, what's good player development, what usually gets in the way, why so many teams seem to struggle with something that would seem so basic, you know, like being a coach and making your players better at basketball is that's AAU stuff, right? It's not even like that's as basic as it gets. And yet it seems to confound so many teams. So I'd been working on that all season, talking to all sorts of teams, and the Heat obviously were one that, I'll say obviously, because I'm guessing your listeners are just saying, yes, indeed, right? But the Heat were a team that comes up often when you hear about good player development, and for good reason, right? Whiteside and Josh Richardson, and I mean, who did I get off the top of my head? Obviously, Robinson and Kendrick Nunn. There are all these examples throughout the years. So I went down to Miami around Christmas, New Year's break.
I saw you there. I remember you talking to Zach Lowe right before that. I think it was that lengthy practice that you referred to in your piece.
Yeah, it was, right. That's why I remembered it, right? I think they told us to get there like 1:15 and we got into practice at like 3, right? I'm not even exaggerating. It was something crazy.
I know. I was there. I remember it. That's pretty commonplace, unfortunately, in Miami. Even yesterday, we had a Zoom call where they tell us, make sure you get there at 12:30. The call was scheduled for 12:45. Eric Spoelstra doesn't come out until about 1:30. So
so I guess we make fun, but hey, like, you know, I can't have it both ways, right? Like, you can't make fun, but then I guess that's part of what works and they get away with it. So I've done a lot of that, and about March 12th, I was 3/4 of the way through and about to file this piece. And then, you know, the world ended, right? And the idea of writing publishing a 3,000-word piece on player development seemed kind of, silly, right?
Yeah, not as important as it once was.
I don't know if anyone was interested. But we're doing a series, and I had to write about the Heat, or I wanted to write about the Heat, and I figured this was the perfect time to sort of reposition it in a way. So I got to keep a lot of my stuff. But that's basically the answer. And I've always been... You know, I put this in the story. It's fascinating what the Heat have done here. I'm stretching it when I call them a contender, but we can call them a contender, even though it's unlikely they make the championship, right? They make the finals. But no high draft picks, no lottery space, and yet they've gone from mediocre and sort of recovered from those Dion Waiters, Kelly Olynyk contracts and seasons, and they've become what they are now, which is an elite team. And that's the sort of thing that seems like it'd be impossible to accomplish if you're not in the NBA, where the one thing we don't reward is mediocrity.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like so much of how – I'm curious how people on the outside perceive Miami's branded hashtag Heat culture as just branding. But the reality is that there is proof that it has worked. And they're fond of saying – I'm sure you've probably heard this before from Spoelstra that, you know, they're not for everyone, that it takes a special kind of mentality to embrace that sort of Heat culture. But I feel like there's a lot of people, particularly on NBA Twitter and things of that sort, but even media members, that kind of look at that sort of attitude from Miami and kind of dismiss it as, well, everybody in the NBA works to a certain extent. But Miami is a little different. I mean, at least that's what you kind of show in your reporting.
For sure. I mean, again, the practice thing is, we're joking about it, but most teams don't practice during the season, really. You know, and if they do, they're certainly not 2-hour grueling sessions. So, you know, they are different. Like, so yeah, obviously some of it is branding and some of it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy, where if you say it enough, everyone believes it and you kind of just, you know, it reinforces it. And Riley's a genius with that. And I mean that kind of complimentary way, right? Like, the whole Riley's been great. Like, Riley gets branding, but he gets it in a way that it's not just about like bolstering his image or selling tickets, but, you know, making himself seem like the godfather. You know, Riley's from a, if you, most people I don't think know that Riley's from a small town in upstate New York, right?
Schenectady, yeah.
Right, it's not like that. That's not the image he gives off, and that's on purpose. So, you know, that guy, the guy from small town New York who grew up, I forget what his dad, you know, factory, whatever. You know, that's not the guy who drops the rings on the table and gets LeBron, right? It's a different kind of thing.
Well, it's always that dichotomy about Riley where it's this polished exterior, but inside it's very much a blue-collar attitude towards basketball. Right. Yeah. And it's always been interesting. I've talked about this on air before, but, you know, one of the things that has worked in Miami so well is that he's always had players who are willing to be an extension of that. Prior to Dwayne Wade, it was Alonzo Mourning, but they've been part of this franchise since 1995 when Riley joined here. Both of them have been on this for like 23 out of the 25 possible seasons. So they've always had either one of those players to kind of be, again, one of those extensions of Riley's attitude. But it doesn't work unless you have those players who are willing to embrace that whole attitude and things of that sort. But
for sure. And that's kind of what I got at a little. I didn't talk about the players, but it's the same idea that sometimes the answers are really simple. So again, going back, how does culture result in player development? How does that end up with, like, you know, how does the idea that we preach Heat culture, how does that lead to Duncan Robinson becoming, going from G League player to like one of the best shooters in NBA history statistically for a season, right? Yeah. And like, it's there's a line there that goes, you know, if there's continuity, there's buy-in from everybody, the people stay the same. So if you come in, you see that Wade did it, you know, and he's still around and he's still talking, and Spoelstra was there in the video room and he rose up, and just, it's all connected. All the stuff is connected. Everyone's on the same page. There's no, you know, there's no loose ends. And you see now when Jimmy Butler, right, he comes in and he bought, and it wasn't all, you know, yeah, he's positioned a little bit that this was his choice solely to go to Miami. That's not exactly true, right? As somebody who's covered the Sixers a lot. But I do think the idea of feeling wanted and the idea of the Heat being the type of team that he was about everything that he was, I think that appealed to him. And we've seen that's made a great combination.
So kind of clarify that a little bit. You don't necessarily think of it as his choice to join the team?
No, I mean, I'm right. You know, the Sixers, there were people in the Sixers who didn't. The Sixers made a choice, I believe.
To move on from Jimmy Butler.
Yeah. Move on from Jimmy Butler and go with the Al Horford route, right? I mean, we've seen, I'm not breaking any news here when I say that Brett Brown and Jimmy Butler were not best of friends, right?
No, right. No, and I, that's fair. It's just, it does come across that way as the narrative around Jimmy is that, well, finally I have a choice. But maybe he had one less option to go to. But there were other suitors in Houston, Los Angeles, and places like that.
For sure. And listen, it's not like it's not necessarily black or white. Like, these things all happen at the same time, right? So you can maybe get a hint that somebody's not so into you, and then you start fishing around other places, things like that. But I don't think it'd be fair to say that Butler initiated the breakup in Philly, right? That's not what happened. That's how I would phrase
that. Do you feel like, if, you know, knowing the Sixers as well as you do, do you feel that if they had been very interested in bringing him back, he would have re-signed there?
That's a good question. I don't know. Honestly, I'm not sure. I mean, the short answer is they have the extra year and the more money, so that always plays a role, right? They could offer that. That helps. The relationship with Brown was an issue. And I don't know how that would have, you know, if we play this out, you know, and he says, I want to come back. I don't know how that then plays out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they would have had to choose, I suppose. I mean, and that would probably have taken a completely different front office.
I mean, I'm guessing, or maybe they start, maybe, and this I'm guessing, right? Maybe you start the year and you see what happens, right? Maybe there's a Brown's hot seat gets hotter faster, right? And he gets replaced. I don't know. Honestly, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay.
It's an interesting question.
Okay. Well, we'll continue talking with Bleacher Report's Yaron Weitzman about Miami's playoff hopes, as well as Dwayne Wade's poor choices on social media. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Reminder to listen to, subscribe, and leave a review whenever possible on your favorite app to listen to podcasts, and that you always get the latest episode by asking your smart device to play Locked On Heat when you get in your car to get your team every day. I found it kind of interesting, Yaron, talking, you know, when reading your piece, and you referenced the summer of 2017, and that one in particular represents such a sticking point for Heat fans, and maybe even going back a season further when they were 2016-17 season, when they went 41-41. because covering that team, let me tell you, that was very difficult from a media perspective, because obviously they started off going 11-30, and everybody is full embracing the tank at that point. And so the expectation was that you get at least a top three draft pick, something that Miami has not had, well, historically. I mean, they had Michael Beasley selected second overall in 2008, but other than that, they had a top five selection in Dwayne. But as you mentioned in your piece, they don't really – they don't honor draft picks the same way in Miami as they do elsewhere. And so you're looking at this team going and struggling, and then all of a sudden they turn it around because they don't embrace the tank. They don't believe in losing games, even when it's obvious around everybody else that maybe they should probably start losing games. And somehow they're able to build themselves up from the mediocre level that you kind of hinted at into maybe not quite a contender, but certainly a very, very good team. It's just – from the outside perspective, do you feel like a team like Miami probably should have tanked harder or should just continue relying on, well, we're going to continue to find players, develop the hell out of them, and get back to winning?
It's a good question. That's a funny question, right? Because I guess I'm going to say, yeah, they probably should have, right? That would have been the move. I get – so LeBron leaves, right? And I get they try to run things back. And the Bosch, the blood clots certainly –
yeah, that changed everything.
Right? That changed a lot because otherwise – Was there another injury after they traded for Dragic? I'm trying to remember. Did Dragic get hurt? I don't know. They made that trade that year, and they were going to have this – what was the lineup going to be? It was going to be Dragic, Wade, Bosch.
Luol Deng, Dwayne Wade. And then – well, they acquired Goran at the trade deadline in 2015. And then that same week, we find out about
– blood clots, right?
So
yeah, and that changed
everything. They were hovering around 500, and the expectation was that they were going to be able to take it up a notch and be a dangerous team in the playoffs. They wound up missing out on the playoffs altogether. And then they go into the lottery, draft Justice Winslow, select Josh Richardson in the second round, and then again make the playoffs that year. And they're within one, I think, game seven against Toronto of making it to the Eastern Conference Finals, even without Chris Bosh, because then he goes down again later on that year. And then that's 2016 already. And then Miami kind of sees the future with Chris that it's not likely that he'll return at 100%. And they kind of have to make a choice with Dwayne Wade as well. And they just elect to not pay him as much as they should. It's another sticking point in franchise history.
Right. And so I get why in the immediate aftermath of the Heatles being broken up, LeBron leaving, you don't tank, right? I get it. Like, that's hard to do. And the team was still good, right? There was no reason to. Like, I'm not one of these people who thinks if you're not a sure thing to be a champion, tank. Like, I think, you know, like the Atlanta, we always pick on those Al Horford Atlanta Hawks teams, right? Like, and you know what? I think I think that's wrong. Those teams were winning 50 games every year, 55. They got 60. They were conference finals teams, few breaks away from making a championship. And like, it's okay to not win a title, right? That's not the point. You want to compete. So I'm okay with
that. My listeners would argue otherwise. I've been making this point for years. It's just so difficult. It's so much take. I mean, look at a historically great team like the Golden State Warriors and you win 3 out of 5, you know, it's not a lock. No matter how talented you are, there's always going to be some X factor that you can't foresee that's going to alter your path towards a championship. And so making that your ultimate goal is futile to me.
I agree. But there is that cutoff, right? And that's where I think the Heat made the mistake. And they think it was a 2017, they should have probably pulled the cord. I mean, I think I'm guessing your listeners would even agree. Like the Olynyk, Waiters, was it James Johnson? Yes. Those deals, that's when it was confusing to understand what Riley and the team were trying to do. Those were Charlotte Hornet type moves, right? Like, we're going to chase like 37 wins.
They kind of leaned into it, I think, a little bit as far as the whole, we want to develop players and we want to show that if you come to Miami and turn yourself around like Deion and James had, that we're going to reward you. And that's good, I think, around the league to kind of show you come to us and we'll take care of you. If you do the work, we'll reimburse you for that work. So I think that was certainly a big part of that, and it didn't quite work out. I mean, with Deion, he wound up getting injured, and Johnson was probably getting a little overpaid, overvalued for what he could do, but, I mean, he was a solid role player. Just this year, it kind of all fell apart. With Jimmy, I think the calculus shifted pretty considerably, where it's your focus now on going a lot deeper in the playoffs and not just reaching the playoffs, and so the expectations for everybody around the team were a lot higher, and when Waiters and Johnson fell short, they were just outcast almost immediately.
And listen, I think the bet they're making, and this is the non-taking bet. One, they're really good at drafting, which I don't know if I would bet on that because that's that seems to be an inexact science. So the Heat seem to be better than a lot of teams. But even they, you know, Justice Winslow is really good, but like they turned out a lot of off. They probably overvalued him, right? So things like that. The other thing they're doing is they've been proven correct on for years, the idea that we can get our, you don't need to clear the decks. We're in Miami, so we can always get in a room with people. And you can clear the cap space when you need to. So whether it's for LeBron or whether it's for Jimmy Butler or whatever, right? We're really good at cap stuff. Andy Ellsberger is a genius there. We're going to figure that out. Again, that might put you in some unnecessary difficulties, whether you have to attack draft picks or whatever to get off of things. But that's the bet they're sort of making, I guess. And it's going to be really interesting now going forward from here, seeing what they do next as they're right on the cusp here.
Well, I mean, you know, obviously the goal is to lure another superstar free agent to pair with mm-hmm. Bam Adebayo and Jimmy Butler. But going back to the focus of your piece on development, sure. I think a lot of Heat fans kind of see Miami as one of the best teams, if not the best team. Were there other teams that you think have had that kind of success over the years that are comparable or if not possibly better than Miami at developing players internally? I think Toronto is a team that gets overlooked a lot, but they've
really... No, Toronto for sure. Toronto's one of them for sure. I just happened to focus on it. You could do a story about Toronto also right now, yeah. Right? You look at their team, what they've done. You can look at the guy, Siakam, Terrence Davis, OG Anunoby, just all these guys. I mean, Siakam's a prime example, right? Like, he's the equivalent of it's more impressive than what happened than what has happened with Bam, right? Siakam was less heralded and it's become, it's better than Bam right now, right? Or at least more of an offensive ceiling. Toronto's up there. Teams like that, and the Spurs are one that get mentioned a lot, still, and some of those disciples like Bud, Milwaukee as an example,
yeah. I think you lost a lot of my listeners there by saying Siakam is better than Adebayo.
I was saying it, I was actually thinking. Now I'm actually genuinely curious. I feel like that's a fun conversation. Not this, we don't have to have it, but I kind of want to look at the numbers and do a dive on that right now.
Yeah, no, I would be interested in seeing it too. I mean, different players. I think a lot of Heat fans kind of gravitate towards a performance earlier this season when Adebayo really shut down.
For sure.
Siakam. For sure. And so I think that they always look at, I mean, they see Adebayo as an elite level defender who's capable of shutting down even great ball handlers, and certainly he is a very, very good defender, but I have concerns about his offensive development as well, although I do look to a game right before the hiatus where he kind of dominated that fourth quarter and he was so good from a scoring perspective and also from a shot creation perspective where he was making plays for everybody. I think it was the last few minutes of a fourth quarter against the Wizards, which you referenced the Wizards, but in a previous loss, which was to me the worst loss of the season. And mm-hmm. this following game against Washington, he winds up just dominating there. It was without Jimmy Butler. A couple other players had gone through injury too, and Bam just takes over the game. And I think that's a glimpse into what his ceiling can be. We haven't seen a whole heck of a lot of that, but then there hasn't been a lot of opportunity because he's been buried behind Hassan Whiteside and others. But I did want to ask a little something about Duncan Robinson. Was there anything that didn't sure. kind of make it into your piece? Because you talked to his agent, Jason Glushon. You talked to a lot of people about Duncan and his, his thought process about joining the Heat and Miami's thought process and adding him to the roster. Was there anything that didn't make it into your piece?
No, I don't think so. I found it I just found the whole thing fascinating, right? How simple it seemed to be, right? Like that day, and I wrote this, the Heat targeted a guy for a specific skill set. I mean, it just showed to me, it was just emblematic of how the whole process, how the machine works, right? They send out Chuck Kammer, who's, I guess your listeners know, right? He's kind of a scouting guru. He spots Duncan out. He goes to a workout. He tells Eric Spoelstra Duncan Robinson's one of the best shooters he's ever seen, right? And that he's big so he can play. Spoelstra stays in touch. They reach out to Duncan Robinson. Duncan Robinson goes undrafted. He chooses the Heat because he thinks that's a great team that could develop him. They don't do anything fancy with him. They just decide, we're going to make him a better shooter, right? I guess that was one of the interesting things that a lot of teams would try to round the guy out like that, be like, oh, you're a great shooter, let's work on ball handling. And I mean, obviously they do that, these guys focus on everything, but the real focus with Robinson was, no, you're going to go from a good shooter to one of the game's best. And just the fact that, again, we talk about the self-fulfilling cycle, at a certain point you help yourself in that way where your reputation precedes itself, and because of that the guy comes in and the guy wants to come in, and not only that, he comes in ready to work and eager to work, and that's a big part of it.
I mean, again, it's kind of hard to see within this insular bubble. Do you feel like a lot of players are willing to do that work? I mean, you know, just looking at Jimmy's situation in Minnesota and maybe even in Philadelphia to some extent, do you feel like players, obviously every player in the NBA has to get there, not just on incredible talent, but also some level of work ethic. Do you think it's a lot harder to manifest the kind of work ethic that Miami expects of you for your typical NBA player?
Yeah, I would say that's not for everybody, or everybody's not cut that way, right? There's a difference between, you know, there's a difference between showing up 20 minutes before practice or 2 hours before practice, right? And for this piece, I spoke to a lot of, you know, player development coaches from different teams, and there are plenty of examples and stories of guys kind of rolling in, not ready to go. And from there, it becomes how are they held accountable and who holds them accountable? And do they believe the team has their best interests? And do they believe the GM is on the same page with the coach, right? Like, it's all, this stuff is all connected, and that's where Miami has a leg up.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Well, we'll finish up our conversation with Yaron Weitzman of Bleacher Report in the next segment. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Just a reminder, they can always reach me via email at lockedonheat@gmail.com or on Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat. You're talking with Yaron Weitzman of Bleacher Report about the Miami Heat and Jimmy Butler, who's recently made the news for dribbling in his room. And it's one of those funny stories where it seems perfectly Jimmy-esque. You know, he's just going to continue to do work. But on the outside, again, it becomes the butt of a joke, and everybody kind of just pokes fun at Butler for, you know, showing up to practice at 3 a.m. and everything else like that. What's your take on that? Because obviously you covered him in Philadelphia to some extent. I wonder if you have a perspective on Jimmy and his work ethic and how that might be overly blown up.
Okay, so the work ethic is legit, right? Yes. It's like that he's really doing that. Like in Philadelphia, he would work out by himself. Like he lived an hour away or something from the facility. He would work out like crazy, then in the gym near him, and then go to practice. So that stuff's all legit. I will never be convinced that showing up to a practice 7 hours early is in any way helpful or beneficial, right? Like just if practice starts at 10:30, when, you know, we're talking about the player development, and, you know, I'm saying there's a difference between guys who roll in 20 minutes early and an hour early, but then like coming in at 4 a.m., I just, you know, I'm never going to be convinced of how that helps you. Yeah. It's the Mark Wahlberg schedule, right? Which I think is nuts, but hey, as a professional athlete, you'll take it. So no, the work ethic, I mean, yeah, I don't even remember what was the question. Is it real? What's my opinion on it? I mean, I think it was kind of funny. Like, yeah, do I as a reporter, do I laugh at like, okay, when what agent? Well, this was a nice place leaked. Let's get the TNT talking about how Jimmy Butler's working out so hard that security had to come talk. You know, tell him to be quiet. Like that, I get a kick out of that. Yeah, I don't know.
it's just, I think. Similarly to 2010, when LeBron joined Miami, you tend to be overprotective of your players as a fan base. And so I think a lot of fans kind of defend Jimmy. And if he wants to work at 3 a.m., it just, again, becomes – is it ridiculous and over the top? Sure. But, I mean, so much of Jimmy's behavior is that way anyway. So I feel like they're a lot more accepting of these kinds of things. And they kind of are a little sensitive to him being the butt of a joke, but that's a whole other situation there. What do you see as far as Miami's ceiling in Orlando? I mean, that's a very complicated situation, and there are so many factors.
That's what I was going to say. I find it so hard to evaluate or prognosticate on anything that's going to happen there. I mean, what I default to is that the idea that typically the NBA playoffs are pretty chalky, right? 1-2, 1-2, we see the best teams advance. More chaos, you would think, would lend itself to more upsets, right? This is sort of chaotic. So I would say that helps the Heat's chances, right? So that's what I would guess there. I mean, they're not as good as the Bucks. They're not as good as the Raptors, I don't think, you know, stuff like that. If this was a normal situation. That said, I'm intrigued that I feel like their game plan will be just, you know, let's see what Jimmy can create. Obviously play great, good D. Though the D was not as good as I'm not telling you anything you don't know, right? But the defensive numbers, given the guys that they have, the talents they have, you'd like to see those numbers be a little better. But also, it's basically shooter roulette is going to be the game, right, for them, I feel like, you know, between Tyler and Kendrick Nunn and Duncan Robinson, all these guys, like, can we get one or two guys hot pregame? And from there, We'll see.
Yeah. Do you have concerns that they're relying on these kind of young players like Duncan and Tyler Hero to you know, and Kendrick Nunn, who's, you know, a rookie, even if he's not a typical rookie, but still, I mean, that's the, you know, so much of their offense comes from those three players.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? It's kind of the downside of all the things I'm giving them props for in the article, right? That, and that it's great that they have all these undrafted or rookie players performing at a high level and playing key roles for them. But that also means you have a bunch of undrafted players and rookies performing in key roles for you in the playoffs, right? And right. Yeah, I'm curious to see how their games translate. Playoff defense is completely different, completely. And I imagine, I'm actually curious. I would imagine teams are usually all scouted up on the opponents. I have a feeling that's going to be even more the case this year. I mean, you have 4 months here where these teams have nothing to do but to self-evaluate and to scout, right? So yeah. You're going to know everything that opponents do. I guess you can throw in a few wrinkles here or there now, but it's like, you know, the Kyle, is Duncan Robinson going to get the Kyle Korver treatment, you know? And I know he's bigger, which makes a difference, and I think that's what one of the things that he like about him.
Yes.
That he's not 6'5", he's 6'8", and that makes it easier to get a shot up and things like that. And he's really good quick release and good coming off screens, and his gravity helps obviously and all that. But no, I'm very curious to see how that goes. I'm also, as great as Butler has been, and Butler was really good in the playoffs last year, and he's shown he can perform. You know, he's also like his end of game numbers have not been great. Like crunch, you know, less shot yeah. stuff this season. I guess I'm glad. I'm just intrigued. I'm intrigued to see what this looks like.
Yeah. I think they are going to be a very interesting team. And I mean, maybe it's kind of overly simplistic, but I feel like if everything goes well for them and they play at the level that they're capable of, they can be pretty dangerous and could even potentially knock off a Milwaukee, who I think has much more higher end talent than they do. But it's you know, there's so much about this whole bubble situation that nobody can really foresee. And so it makes it very difficult, as you said, to really guess and look ahead and say, well, this is all going to work out the way we expect it to. We've never seen this kind of situation before, so that makes it virtually impossible. But moving away from the basketball court, I did want to bring up with you the most recent situation with Dwayne Wade, where he made some really terrible – well, he tweeted support for Nick Cannon, who, as we all know, made some terribly anti-Semitic comments on a podcast and was eventually fired by CBS for those comments, and rightfully so. And then Dwayne, you know, as a person that's revered in South Florida, unfortunately – tweeted support of Cannon and then deleted that tweet. And I know you were critical of him. I think a lot of people around the league were critical of Dwayne, but not as many as should have been. And I just kind of wanted to get your take on it because, you know, obviously Dwayne holds such a special place for Miamians and South Floridians. You know, he's been long thought of as a hero of the culture here and everything else. And then all of a sudden, you know, there is a large Jewish population in South Florida. And so I think a lot of those people are fans of Dwayne and the team. And then all of a sudden he just really ruined everything by tweeting support for Nick Cannon. And although his apology has been somewhat sincere, I wonder if you take it very seriously.
Okay. So what did we get? Yeah. I was very annoyed by the comments. I was annoyed. Well, I shouldn't say the comment, right? I know we're meta here. The comment about the comment, right? But the idea that, you know, expressing support for Nick Cannon, who this wasn't even like there's hidden anti-Semitism and there's what Nick Cannon said, right? That was a different level. And this, even I think Wade's tweet was even before Cannon had walked his back, if I remember correctly. If I'm getting the time, I might be wrong on that one, but I think
you're right. I think you're right. Yeah.
Before Cannon walked his back, and just saying support him, yeah, that was, and you know, I got angry at that. It's obviously we're seeing a problem here, that within that there's a, I'm not going to say anti-Semitism within the NBA, but there's an acceptance of it of some fringes, right? In all sports, we're going to start with the Deshaun Jackson thing. And there's deeper issues here, right? In terms of how the black community, some parts of the black community view Jews and historical things and all that, that I'm not completely qualified to talk about, right?
Right. Did you have a feeling that there was this kind of acceptance around the NBA? I mean, having covered it for as long as you have?
Okay, so I've never experienced it. I'll be clear about that. Yeah. I'm aware of, like, you know, we get to the Farrakhan stuff and like that. I'm aware of all those histories and all that. And you kind of, you know, draw dots between things. To me, though, a lot of it goes back to an education, right? The idea of that. Like, so let's go to Deshaun Jackson for a second. Deshaun Jackson, to me, maybe I'm being too forgiving. To me, that was ignorance, not hate. That's how I read that as a Jew, right? Because I'm just not, maybe I'm naive. I don't think anyone, like if you, you know, David Duke wouldn't try to quote Hitler, right? He would be more veiled about it. He would say George Soros, right? Like nobody, like you have to be actually not even, like wear a hood to quote Hitler. I just think that was Deshaun Jackson not knowing who he's talking about. So that was ignorance. And he's since expressed a willingness to address that ignorance. And that's all you can really ask for. And I'm going to, an aside here, this stuff always gets complicated because there are a lot of bad actors out there who are more than happy to pounce on this stuff for the sole reason of undercutting the Black Lives Matter movement, right? And we're just kind of waiting in the weeds. And I'll just be clear, that is not me. And that's not what I'm trying to do here. And I don't, to me, these things are connected in a way that oppressed people should be supporting each other, right? It's the Kareem, right. It's what Kareem say, injustice for one is injustice for all, whatever, right? It's just, we're all connected on this stuff. But the way comments bother me, yeah, the way comments bother me, because it showed ignorance in terms of what, either he was just supporting the canon without knowing what he was talking about, which Dwayne Wade should not be doing. Has too much of a profile or platform to do that, or he had seen what Nick Cannon said and had no issue with it. And then to try tweeting through it, then he deletes his tweet, doesn't say anything before deleting his tweet. Then he tries tweeting through it and like starts like retweeting like Chris Bosh, like Substacks, right? And then he gave out his first apology was what? That I was supporting Nick Cannon, the brand, like the content, which right. To me is like, okay, so like I don't support the KKK, but I admire how they've really branded white hoods.
I like their laundry. I like their robes, you know.
Right. I'm not saying the Cannon's KKK, but to me, like, that's a ridiculous comment, right? And
absolutely.
Something that we would not, and I hate whataboutism, I really do, but it would not be accepted if we were talking about different communities, right? So yeah, that bothered me. And then Wade has yet to address it. And what's I'm frustrated, and I tweeted this at him. I didn't expect him to respond, but the idea that, and this is what Deshaun Jackson is doing and why I'm willing to forgive, and you know, I kind of almost look at this as a happy ending to Deshaun Jackson's situation. But the idea that you made a mistake, what are you doing? Not only to apologize, but to address it and help the problem. Dwayne Wade is somebody who has spoken out against hate and prejudice before. He's aware of his platform. He uses it. You made a mistake here. If you say you acknowledge your mistake, do something about it, right? You know, have a Instagram live with a Haka survivor. I'm making that up, right? Something like that. Show something that you're going to realize that you realize what you did was dangerous.
I find myself, and maybe, you know, being Jewish, you probably have a very, very different perspective than I do, but I tweeted something out as a joke, you know, a couple of weeks ago where I remember a time when I didn't need Indiana Jones to remind me that Nazis were all pieces of shit.
What?
Like, like how have we gone to this point now where we just don't hear anybody even thinking or supporting, whether by accident, a Nazi? And it's just like, well, that's just bad. Like there's no middle ground here. And I don't understand. I mean, I know you kind of try to gloss over or explain it that maybe it's just a lack of education, but it just seems like it's such a simplistic premise. Nazi equals bad, and there's no way around it. There's no two-siding that sort of thing. And I just it's just so hard. Like for again, Dwayne, given his own personal history and his connection to South Florida and the fact that there is a large Jewish population here, you would think he would know better. And I don't know how to wrap my mind around it. And I think of fans kind of overlook it. There's been a very marked, quiet about the anti-Semitic comments around just not the NFL, but the NBA as well. And it's just, you know, you got Steven Jackson saying what he did. It's just, I don't know what the next step is. I feel like now all of a sudden the thread is loose and all of a sudden we're going to start unspooling ourselves here and revealing a much darker side than would have ever expected from the league, especially a league filled with as many black men as possible that have been, you know, again, minimized as a marginalized as a race. It's just, I don't know. Maybe I'm kind of rambling here, but I just find myself.
No, I agree. I think what you said, I should have said, right, that was one, what kind of started this, right? You said Deshaun Jackson and Steven Jackson defending him and doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on his defense. And by defending him, he was, to be clear, and you know this, but I'm not telling you something you don't know, but he was defending someone's use of Hitler said,
yeah.
Jews are bad, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, my wife says it all the time. It's like, well, Hitler was a vegetarian and loved his dog, but he was still a piece of shit. I mean, there's no way around it. I mean,
when the quote, and I guess people know it wasn't actually Hitler, but when the purported quote starts with Hitler said,
yeah,
and ends with Hitler was right, I don't think you have to even fill anything between. But even so, there was plenty in there that you kept reading. So it was yeah, and the fact, yeah, and I was, as a Jewish person who I'm saying, I've been looking at this, and again, I'd like to think of myself as supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement and sure. as racially aware as other white people, and yet even as always, and yet even over the past couple months, I've tried to be more introspective about this stuff and think about it more and try to see, okay, where am I falling short? Where am I coming up short? As somebody who's done that, I am hurt that that is not happening from an MBA community that I, you know, I'm around and care about, and that is that the reverse is does not seem to be happening, and that is, I find that bothersome and worrisome and scary. So yeah,
I feel like we could possibly spend hours talking about this and obviously not get any kind of significant resolution, but I thank you for coming onto the show and adding your perspective to a conversation that needs to be had and needs to continue to be had, unfortunately. But it's I think something that is going to continue to impact us at least in the near future, and hopefully we can do our part to remove it from being a topic that needs to be discussed. But even then, we still have to continue to remember the atrocities that took place. But why don't you tell my listeners where they can continue to follow you, and of course where they can get your book, which is a fantastic read. From everything I've heard, I have not had the time recently to get the copy of the book, but I will make sure that I do so.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah, you can check me out on Twitter at Bleacher Report. You can get the book if you're interested in learning about the Sixers and the process, or I like to think it's more about just how the NBA works, you know, behind the scenes and things. You can check it out, Tanking to the Top. It is available, as they say, where all books are sold.
Excellent. Well, coming up later this week, I'll be continuing to bring the latest info on what's going on in Orlando. I'll be recording a show with the Washington Post, Ben Golliver from Inside the Bubble, so make sure to stay tuned for that. Be sure to subscribe and follow this podcast right now on your favorite podcast app to get the latest episode of Locked On Heat as soon as it's out. I'm David Ramil signing off and thanking you as always for your support.
Back it up, B.